Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
And he saw me and he kind of went, ah, Tommy, how are you? And I said, John, you're enjoying yourself, are you? And he goes, what other chief executive of a football association in Europe would you see doing this?
Welcome all to episode 56 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with Misha Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Tommy Martin. You'll know Tommy is the face of Virgin Media's football coverage, and he also has a very, very good column in the Irish Examiner once a week. So we will get to the chat with Tommy in a moment, but a reminder to get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can also tweet me, I'm at gcooney93. Or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. It is in that WhatsApp group that you can join the conversation with like-minded fans Behind the Lines. You can submit questions and topics of conversation for future guests. And it's there we trade our favourite reading recommendations for that week. So you can get involved, as I said, by following the episode description of this podcast. Also, do get in touch if you want our mega PDF doc collated with all of our guest picks over the 56 episodes of this series so far. It's a hell of a reading list, and it'll keep you going right across Christmas. But that is enough for me. Let us get to our conversation with Tommy Martin. Thanks, Martin, for doing the show. So we'll start talking about you for a few minutes, if you're not too bashful. How did you break into telly? Like, did you always want to do it?
It's kind of a long and winding road, really. I suppose I didn't always want to be on telly in that kind of way. Like, I wasn't, you know, child, Billy Barry kid or anything like that, and wasn't sort of like that. But I suppose as I grew up through my teens, and kind of had an urge to be in journalism and broadcasting was something. I had a kind of a vague sense of, I think it was actually around Euro 2000, I remember, because it was kind of getting a bit like, what am I going to do with my life sort of age. And I remember that was such a great tournament that I kind of had this weird sort of sense of like, God, that would be way better than doing an actual job for a living. Like, you know, just being around that and being sort of, just, you know, and whether as a commentator or, you know, broadcasting around it or writing or, you know, reporting on it in some way, I kind of thought like that would be, that's way better. Because at the time, I had left college and I was working in an office job. I was working in a bank and just, I maybe had been working for about a year, and I was kind of like, pretty sure this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life. So that sort of started to percolate. And then, but it was a bit of a long, winding road. I actually ended up working for another few, doing a bit of traveling and putting off making a decision about my future for another couple of years. And then I decided then, this was the mid-noughties, right, I'm going to do something about this now. And I started a blog back when blogs were the thing. Blogs were the, I suppose, like the podcasts of their time, and like social media, any kind of social media, actually. It was like, which was called Tom's Sporting Almanac. So I don't know, it might still be on the ether. It was like a blog spot thing. And I used to work, I was still working in the bank, and I used to desk every day. I'd get my work done as quick as possible, and then just write like every day, try and write something, some kind of comment piece about something to do with sports. I mean, like, you know, try and publish something every day, and generated a loyal following of literally tens of readers. So that was kind of the start. And then I said, look, I have to, you know, this is all well and good. So I sent a few demos into some radio stations, and got a bit of part-time work with 98FM, just reading sports bulletins in the morning. The late great Johnny Lyons rang me up out of the blue and said, hi, Tommy, I've listened to your demo. I want you to come in and do sports bulletins at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning. And I was like, that's my dream job. I'll be there. So I was literally thrown on air and kind of made it from there. And then basically I was working Monday to Friday in the bank, Saturday and Sunday at 98FM. And then my wife was actually training. She was changing careers as well. I met her in the bank, and her friends in the teacher training course was actually the fiance and now wife of Brian O'Donovan, the Washington correspondent with RTE, who was a reporter in TV3 at the time, and casually mentioned that some people had left. I think like Darren Frahill and Joanne Cantwell had been working in TV10, just left to go to RTE, and they just needed bodies in the building, basically. So I threw in a CV in there, and they were obviously desperate enough. I was just a complete chancer in, and kind of just sort of scuffled my way up through the up from the factory floor there over a period of time.
I do remember. I remember the first time I saw you on telly. It was I think you were doing Europa League games with Liverpool's Europa League games for a channel that then called 3E. And I think the pundit was Mark Wright, if I'm right. And I was absolutely magnificent because you were introing something about Liverpool's dodgy defence and Liverpool's, we'll call him stocky left back, Emiliano Insua. And you threw to Mark Wright, was like, Mark, is the problem with Emiliano Insua not that he's just got a big fat arse? It's like, yes, this is the kind of TV I want to watch. It was great. And when you were watching Euro 2000, like, are you sitting watching someone being like, I want to be like them, I want to be like Bill O'Herlihy or Des Lynam, or is it just broadly the gig?
Is Des still going? I suppose he might just have been. He might have made the ill-fated move to ITV at that stage. But like growing up, I always think in terms of like TV, that I kind of feel like having that I grew up in a golden age. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's certainly, maybe everybody thinks of their childhood in that way. But in the 80s, there wasn't as much TV, sport on TV, obviously, as there is now, but there was more variety. And if you felt like there was like to everything a season. So in, you know, there was always like sports stadium and grandstand, badminton and rally driving and stuff. But in terms of the big events, in the spring, the Six Nations happened. You know, in the summer, Wimbledon, British Open, golf, the Tour de France. And you got massively into all of those as the year went along with, even with, there was very little GA on TV at the time. So that almost had its kind of summer season as well. And then you had your, you know, the big match on ITV on a Sunday. I think RTE had some Saturday games. And then you had the odd big European tie on the weekdays. So it just felt like everything, there wasn't the sort of saturation that we have now. It's great now that you can see pretty much anything you want to see, but it, you know, without wanting to romanticize it too much, everything felt like a big event back then, even if it was like the badminton horse trials or something, you know, and you like go around pretend to setting up a show jumping arena and you're, you know, the Aga Khan trophy in your back garden. And so like to me, like thinking back now, I suppose like Des Lynam would have been the most, you know, if I could look back and say, like, who was the guy you would have thought, like, is the consummate at what you do? And, like, to me, he had such a balance of charm, skill, journalistic ability, and also, you know, the ability to go from, I mean, everybody remembers his one-liners and his intros and, you know, the famous one when England were playing in World Cup 98, and it was like an afternoon game, and he opens the program and just says, shouldn't you be at work? You imagine, like, you know, 20 million people are tuning in, and he's not gone with something big and bombastic. He just goes with that little sort of line. But yes, I always remember when Ben Johnson got done for doping in Seoul 88 games, watching the BBC coverage, and it was Des Lynam being handed a piece of paper and saying, I've just been handed a piece of paper, and delivering that sort of, which was a grave story at the time, because it was almost like the shroud has been taken from our eyes. Now we see that like it was like the end of innocence, really, in terms of what these guys were. And I was what, about 11 at the time, maybe. So, you know, that was a real kind of like, wow, the 100 meters is like, we didn't know, like, certainly 11-year-olds didn't realize that such, you know, such wrongdoing could exist, and it wasn't all heroes and triumphs and you know, everything being golden, like, so he was really formative, like, and like, but looking back now, like, everything anybody in our side in Ireland in the job that I do is always referenced around Bill O'Herlihy, because, but at the time, now I have to say, my father was we were a football house because my father was Glaswegian, and there was a sense when they were doing their thing in the 80s and 90s and soccer was becoming big in Ireland, that what the RT panel did brilliantly was almost bringing the game to an audience that weren't necessarily as familiar with it as they might have been with the archetypal sort of GAA audience maybe. And I think a lot of Giles's appeal in particular was in that he people kind of said, well, this guy knows what he talks about. He's teaching us about the game. And in our house, like, my dad was Johnny Giles. Like, he'd just be watching it, and he would be being an argumentative sort of opinionated Glaswegian. He thought he knew everything about football. Like, he was almost Dunphy and Giles, because he felt he had the authority of Giles with the sort of the one-liners of Dunphy. But like, so what Bill was doing there, I didn't realize at the time, but only later, you know, to sort of draw that and create the chemistry of a panel, kind of, you know, you have to think that sort of percolates into what you do.
Yeah. Did you only kind of realize what Bill did really well when you started doing the same job?
Yeah. Well, no, I'd like to think that, you know, as I kind of grew older and realized the value that, you know, when I was a kid, like, I thought my dad knew everything. I don't need Johnny Giles to tell me. And then I kind of realized, you know, my dad would always say, or his father used to say to him, you know, when you're 16, you think your dad's an idiot. When you're 21, it's amazing what he's learned in 5 years. So, like, when you're a kid, like, you think your dad knows everything, and then when you're a teenager, you kind of realize, well, maybe he doesn't know everything. So at the time, I probably, you know, didn't realize that skill. But as I got older, and it was clear that sort of what they had was a very special thing, then, you know, you did realize what was involved. But as you say, only when you start to do it yourself, and to make it look easy, because I always kind of thought like that everybody has their own different style, but one thing you have to make it not look like, you have to try and make it look like it's not that much hard work, because nobody wants to watch somebody on TV that looks like they're it looks like this is hard work for me. Like, so to take all the kind of elements that are going on behind the scenes, which you don't know about until you're actually doing the job, and still manage to create that sort of having a chat sort of and still maintain the kind of journalistic, you know, flow of the whole thing. Like, yeah, you don't realize until you do it, I suppose.
Yeah. Are you proud of where your Virgin Media's coverage is now? I think it's really good. I think it's outstripped RT by a considerable margin at this point.
Yeah, like, very proud. Like, I mean, when I started, like, my first ever game was that I'd ever did live. I'd only been in the company for about a year, and it was like the 2009 UEFA Cup semi-final between Manchester City. We're playing, this is the city, the Mark Hughes city with Stephen Ireland, and they were playing, I'm going to say maybe Werder Bremen in a UEFA Cup semi-final. And we actually had that was the only football we had. We had like the two semi-finals and the final of the UEFA Cup, because the way the rights went at the time, it was like we had nothing. And so basically it was like, well, there's no point hiring a big name presenter for two crappy games. So let's just throw this guy in who, you know, seems vaguely competent at reading autocue. And at that stage, it was, you know, it was really like, it was pretty cheap and cheerful. Cheerful as a stretch. I don't mean to denigrate it, but it was they as a company, they weren't investing in it at the time. And like the problem with sport on TV, especially in Ireland, when you're being compared to your peers in Montrose and in the UK, is that you have to put a bit of love into it. And I think around the time of the Rugby World Cup, maybe in 2015, maybe before that, but there was certainly a sea change, and they realized we have to do this right. So there was a bit of investment in the studio to make it look a bit sexier. Big investment in rights and going out and actually getting good rights, like Champions League, you know, Champions League and Europa League, and lots of things. So you weren't just popping up every 2 weeks, you were there every week, and things like Six Nations and Rugby World Cup and all that. So you were getting into a lot more homes, and then going and getting somebody like Graeme Souness, who kind of makes people sit up and notice and kind of go, oh, that's Souness. Like, he's, he's like won three European Cups, and you know, it's kind of like the kind of rejoinder to any, because I know obviously he has his critics, but you know, he just, it's a kind of a shows your medals kind of thing. Like, but someone like him is, I kind of only realize it when I watch him on Sky, and I kind of realize he's so magnetic on TV. Like, he's got extraordinary charisma, and you can argue the point about his opinions and his punditry, but he's incredibly watchable. So you got an element like that, and then you know, you bring in, like, I remember first time I worked with Brian Kerr was when Shamrock Rovers got to the Europa League, and we happened to have the rights, and it was like, well, great. It was suddenly they qualified, and we had to kind of, okay, who are we going to get? So Brian had kind of been, he was in his sort of in his Pharaohs phase at that time, and I worked with him one of the games, and I said to the producers, I said, like, I've learned more about football, or I've listened to, or been more interested in somebody talking about football in that 20 minutes of Brian after the match than I've done with anybody else we've had. And as you were saying, we were flying over people like Mark Wright and, you know, Phil Babb and different people just because they were kind of names. But suddenly we're like Brian, like he lives 15 minutes away, and he's kind of the essence of Irish football, like if you want to boil it down. So you got someone like him, you got someone like Graham, and different people down the years then, the young, like likes of, you know, Keith Andrews and Kilbane and Damien Delaney now, the younger voice. Someone like Niall Quinn, who's kind of like a face that people kind of makes them think of happy times and in the past as well, and brings a kind of a unique take as well. Someone like Neil Lennon, who worked with, who's obviously probably hankering for the safety of a TV studio now, given the tough time he's having. But you know, he was great to work with. But I think so. Certain pillars like that, you kind of sit back then and kind of realize, like, actually, right, we've come a long way. And you know, to give you a much shorter answer, we'd be pretty proud, all right.
Yeah, and obviously, I look at most things through the prism of Irish football. But when all the fallout was happening last year, it was you guys who were the destination. I felt maybe it's just a function of you had the rights. You know, you had more Champions League rights and Nations League rights and so on. But those conversations were really good, and especially with the likes of Brian and with Niall Quinn. And then you could see, I was interested in what Souness thought, and he was like, "These guys, like, what the hell is going on over here?" And like, how did you enjoy those? I don't know if you ever got the full "I've just been handed a piece of paper here" treatment, but I guess it was a good time to be on TV talking about.
Yeah, it was great because we had I think we picked up like the rights to internationals and Nations League as sort of quite late in the day. That there's different packages, and we got, you know, we got quite a lot of stuff that we didn't necessarily expect. So we were kind of on air a lot around those international weekends, with, you know, without actually having the live Irish games, and we were just on, and you would get something like the Gibraltar statement where, you know, John Delaney was, and like that was monumental at the time, like, because it was, you got it first, and you said it, and it said, John, you know, I think it came out like maybe we were doing like Spain against Norway or something on a Saturday evening. And the Gibraltar match had kind of finished, and it was coming out around that time. It was after the Gibraltar match, wasn't it? And then suddenly you get a thing saying John Delaney is stepping down as chief executive, and you're suddenly like, "Wow, yeah, you've been handed a piece of paper. This is big news." And you're kind of trying to read through this, you know, famously long, statement, and kind of go, "Oh, he's sticking around," like, he's, and sort of percolate all that through as well. You know, that's great. It's great to be on air for moments like that. And then just to react, you know, because every day there seems to be a new story, like the hearings in the Oireachtas. You know, we might be on with a Champions League game, so you could give a reaction to that. And I think the bottom line with Brian and Niall, particularly Brian, who everybody knows has, there was a sense in the earlier years that people said about Brian that maybe, oh, he's only bitter because John Delaney didn't renew his contract at the time. And then people kind of realized over the years that actually, no, it was a much deeper grievance based on things that we all know about now that have come out with the reporting over the last few weeks. You know, real things that were done to him on a personal level that were beyond just, you know, renewing your contract or have you done a good job, and a lack of honor with which he was treated at the time. And also the fact that he is regarded as someone who has a pure, you know, the pure good fortune of, or good, the pure good of Irish football, like, is, you know, is his foremost concern. Like, so when something's been exposed on one hand with the FAI Delaney stuff, and you've got Brian sitting there, then what he says is obviously going to really resonate. Like, and then you got someone like Niall who felt he could pull people together and maybe sort things out. And I know when he went in, then it probably wasn't as straightforward as all that, but people kind of saw him maybe as somebody who would be a better face around Irish football than the one that was there at the time. So all that was a really kind of not fortunate, but a really happy coming together of elements. And you felt you could really push the story along. And you know what it's like when there's a big story developing? People want to hear informed and relevant people give their views on it. And it's almost like a kind of a national therapy session, because people say Brian Kerr is saying it's a disgrace what's happened, and they go, yes, it is a disgrace, and I feel a bit better about it now. Let's go and do something about it. So, but it was, yeah, it was extraordinary. It has been an extraordinary couple of years on that front.
Tom's Sporting Almanac has since become a weekly column in the Irish Examiner. How do you? They're always great. Like, I mean, how do you find? Do you find it difficult to write weekly column?
Yes, in the sense that, you know. I know you would understand yourself. You don't want to write any old shit. So when you have a weekly column, when you have a weekly column, it has to get filled. You know, it's the paper doesn't refuse ink. So, you know, you need to file at a certain time, and because the lads on the Examiner desk, they don't care about you agonizing about, I don't know if this is, it has to be. It has to be there, and it has to be the in, because it has to go to press. So I kind of find that it's like, you know, I think every columnist, you know, finds that some weeks you kind of nail it and you kind of go, I'm really happy with that. And some weeks you kind of go, yeah, it's okay. It's got, you know, there's about three good paragraphs in there. So I kind of find that usually if you have a decent idea filtering in sort of early in the week, then it's a good thing, because you got time to kind of hone it a bit in your head and then get down and write it. If you're sitting there in the sort of 2 hours before you have to file, and you're sort of going, this is rubbish, this is the worst idea ever, then, you know, it might not be as good. But it's probably the most, I always say there's different buzzes out of everything you do. I'm sure you find with doing this as well, like, broadcasting is a sort of amphetamine hit to the brain of, like, oh, you know, like big wave surfing kind of, you know, whereas writing is a more sort of, you know, mellow, high sort of, it's a deeper kind of satisfaction that you get from it. And so they're completely different disciplines. And I think that's why I'd hate not to have it, because it's like somewhat a completely different instrument that you're playing.
And it's the kind of thing that begins at the beginning of the week for you and percolates throughout the week then, because I remember we had Keith Duggan on here a couple of months ago and asked him about his column, and he says, I write it on a Friday and then I forget that I ever have to write a column again until I wake up Friday morning. And I was thinking, for fuck's sake, are you serious?
I don't think I could live the seat of my pants like that.
No.
But I do understand the feeling of when you file it, the relief that it's done for another week, because it does build up in your head into this, it does develop this sort of, you know, growing anxiety in your head that, like, the idea you've had for the column is just the worst, flimsiest idea that anybody's ever had. And then sometimes an idea just grabs you by the throat and just says, like, you have to, you know, this is the thing to write. And, you know, and that is the mentality. Like, I just couldn't, maybe it's the timing of it, that I guess if you write in a column for a Saturday paper, you have a full week of comings and goings in the world of sport to sort of say, right, I'm just going to go with whatever is the most resonant to me on a Friday morning. Whereas if you're writing somewhere on Thursday, you got to have it written on a Wednesday. You're kind of thinking about it. You know, so you're a little bit in last weekend and a little bit in something that's happened. So it's more of a kind of a snapshot in the middle of a week, you know. It's not as but look, it's, I think it's all just in the head of the person who who's trying to make sense of whatever nonsense is in their brain. Mm.
Right, we'll jump into your picks, so, Tommy. The first of which is Hero Worshipped by His Own People, which is a piece that Hugh McIlvany did the days after the death of Jock Stein. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about this piece and why you picked it?
Yeah, well, I when I was thinking about this and I was thinking about like formative influences and, you know, what, why did you decide to write? Like, I'd always have my memory of, you know, of Sundays in our house was like after Mass, you were sent in to get the papers. And we got the Sunday Mail, which was a Scottish tabloid, which basically had all the football stuff because we were like Celtic house. My dad was like lifelong, you know, Celtic man. And that was all that was our sort of creed in our house. And then the Observer and the Sunday Tribune. And the Observer at the time when I was growing up, McIlvany was there, and he was, you know, that was in his pomp sort of towards the end of his really peak years. And I always could feel like that my dad would kind of say like, that's McIlvany, like, you know, that's, you know, that's the real stuff. That's like your eat your dinner kind of, you know, read your McIlvany, like, in, you know, because he would be of the same background as the men that McIlvany, like, McIlvany's from Ayrshire, my dad was from Glasgow, and that sense of west of Scotland, industrial heyday is where my father grew up, and a lot of the values that kind of came through, but also the appreciation of the power of language. Like, I was a memory of, you know, when I think about writing in my house, like, I think about things you read, but I also remember, like, my dad was a great letter writer, and I don't mean, like, you know, letters to old sweethearts and stuff, but, like, he'd write a letter to the county council looking for, like, you know, some tar for the road, and he'd say, like, have a read of that, and it would be, like, this kind of muscular, you know, McIlvany type prose that he'd be, you know, making a case to get, like, a new street lamp out to on the dark corner, and he'd always be, like, very proud of the sort of the grammar and all that. And I think maybe it was the British education system of the 50s that kind of instilled that sort of you know, appreciation for clauses and tenses and the proper use of language. So anyway, Julie, a lamppost or a bit of tar would arrive at our house 6 weeks later. I just imagine some poor council official kind of going, God, yeah, whatever, just give him what he wants. So McIlvany was the man. And plus the Celtic angle, like, I always remember when I was only about 7 or 8 when Jock Stein died. And I remember my mother saying to us, just don't annoy your father today. He's a bit sad, you know, one of his heroes has died. Like, so I didn't realize it at the time. So reading McIlvany then, you know, you kind of, and now obviously then in the years to come became, you know, obsessed with Stein and his team and what he built there. But like, the great thing I love about this is, you know, it's what I think I would like to think good sports writers do, great sports writers do, and great writers do, is to make it bigger, you know, make the thing bigger than what it is. And he's writing about a big man, like the section in McIlvany on football, the compilation is, you know, the big man and other story and the big man and other giants. But it was, he made it more about, he made it as much, made it as much about what Stein represented and the people he represented and the times he represented, and also the loss of that sort of working class culture. I mean, people might know that the famous first line, you know, the larcenous nature of death, its habit of breaking in on us when we are least prepared and stealing the irreplaceable, has seldom been more sickeningly experienced than at Ninian Park in Cardiff on Tuesday night. So like the larcenous nature of death, like, it's just those, that great McIlvanyism, that sort of real, like, so you always think of McIlvany, you think of that sort of industrial, you know, yes, British culture of the time where it was about craftsmanship. And like, I always think of his sentences and his writing as being like, it's really strong. It's like a ship, you know, it's not like a lot of writing today is kind of whimsical and jokey and kind of an arched eyebrow. His was very, it's always very serious. It was like, you know, it was like turned by a lathe, you know, it was like, it was, you know, had that sort of real iron kind of quality about it. And people kind of take the mick out of it a bit in the times. Since, but what he goes, I think the bit that gets me about this is how he makes Stein's ethos, how it represents the working class culture of the time. You know, he says his achievements in football were monumental, but they can only partially explain his impact upon and relevance to so many lives. Perhaps he was cherished simply because he was a true working class hero. And that is a species which is disappearing almost as fast in industrial Scotland as elsewhere, if only because the values that governed its creation are being relentlessly eroded day by day. Even the common misery of unemployment has not halted the fragmentation of a sense of community that once seemed indestructible. So he's placing Steen in this like hugely in this context of the, you know, the working class culture that was being just, this is 1985, so Thatcherism is in full swing, and you know the miner strikes are in full swing, and all that sort of working class culture, that sense of community has been destroyed. And he goes on to talk about, you know, conversations with Steen about his time down the pits, and how, you know, Steen, he's quoting Steen saying, "There's nothing as dark as the darkness down a pit, the blackness that closes in on you if your lamp goes out. You think you would see some kind of shapes, but you can see nothing but the inside of your head. I think everybody should go down the pit at least once to learn what darkness is." And he's talking about how the people in the pit, they looked after each other, and they were, he says, you know, he worked 11 years, and wherever I went, whatever work I did, I'd never be alongside better men. So it's just this weird kind of like, oh my God, it's just so, you know, it's just this harking back to a time when you know, things were just different and communities were strong and people were, and maybe it's romantic in his eyes, but it's very powerful.
And that comes full circle at the end. The pain of his death from a heart attack dug deepest into his wife Jean and into Ray and George, the attractive, strong-minded daughter and son of whom he was so proud. But there were many others in many places who felt last week that they did not have to go down a pit to know what real darkness was. And like the other line I had run my pen beneath was, his was the kind of loyalty to his roots that made his principles universal, which is just really great. And then this paragraph is still kind of relevant today, perhaps more relevant than ever. These days, it is hard to avoid having the eardrums battered by some unlikely pillar of the new right, who, having persuaded himself that a largely fortuitous ability to kick a football or volley a tennis ball or belt out a pop song or tell a few jokes more acceptably than the next man, is actually evidence of his own splendid mastery of his fate, insists that the dole cues would fade away overnight if people got off their arses, got on their bikes and showed the enterprise that has carried him to what he imagines as glory. Steen's whole life was a repudiation of such garbage. Such garbage has kind of held on. Does Graeme Souness know that you're a Celtic fan?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a subject of much mirth and jests. And actually, when I was a boyhood Celtic fan, it was, you know, when Souness went to Rangers, and I won't be overstating it by saying that in our house he was considered the devil incarnate. Like he was the man who rescued Rangers from the mire, and not only that, he was the nation of Rangers in terms of like that belligerent sort of, you know, that attitude, that we are the people attitude that they have. Like, so when I was told I was going to be working with them, I was like, oh my God, this is just, you know, you gotta, when you work with football people, you know, and I think we're going to talk about ball four now in a minute, but a lot of the layers and myths that are projected onto them aren't real. You know, it's a lot of it is just myth making.
Let's talk about Ball 4 by Jim Bouton. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about this book and why you picked it?
This was recommended to me by Billy Joe Padden, the former Mayo and Armagh footballer, who's a big baseball fan. And I was doing another conversation about sports books, and he said, like, you have to read this. And I think it was a Time magazine or Sports Illustrated actually had it as their third best book of the century, sports book of the century, published in 1970, I think. So it's a diary of a baseball player called Jim Bouton, who's playing for an expansion team, which is like a new club in Seattle. And he's 30 and his powers are fading. He's trying to basically hang on in his career. He had been a star with the New York Yankees and won the World Series in 1963, I think. and being an all-star, and he had an amazing fastball, and he was in the sort of glory era. The glory era of the Yankees with people like Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle and all these guys, and won the World Series. But he got in terrible injuries and was basically hanging on the stage of his career. And he was always kind of a bit of a free thinker within the game, and used to get into trouble for the stuff he said. So he was approached by a sports writer and said, "Do you ever think about doing a diary of a season?" And he said, "Actually, I've been keeping notes, and basically what transpired like blew open." Like I talked about, like the sort of images, the kind of fans' image of sport and the sort of golden, you know, everything's rosy and everything's perfect. This basically did for baseball, you know, it just completely blew the whole thing apart. It was like it documented, you know, everybody hated him after it because in hilarious style with brilliant witty prose and sparing no detail. Basically, all the players were shagging around, boozers. They used to say about the fans, what they used to say about the bosses, how the bosses were trying to screw the players out of money, how all the managers, the coaches were completely clueless, and like just, you know, he'd be saying like my pitching coach said this today, and it was complete nonsense. How there was all, you know, the dressing room was full of like either, you know, all these dumb jocks who, you know, on one side are good old boys who are boozing. And there's one, like, one passage where he talks about how they used to go on the road and they stayed at a certain hotel, I think maybe in LA or wherever it was. And they loved this hotel because there was a spot where there was a room where they could go to and basically spy on women in other hotel rooms. So he's right. So you remember, he's writing this, like, it comes out like the year after, all these players are still in action, and he's blown the lid on the whole sort of rosy image of baseball and baseball heroes, and they're all, you know, great guys, and it's considered the first sort of sports book that did that to that level. I think, like, you know, it was inspired Eamon Dunphy's Only a Game, in terms of being the completely frank diary. It led to, there was a thing called a reserve clause, which was a bit like the system in soccer where the clubs held your registration after your contract went out, you know, that the Bosman rule got rid of. There was a situation like that in baseball and exposing, and this book kind of led to that, or helped lead to that being overturned. But more than that, like, it's just an unbelievably, it's just a really fun read because he's so honest about what was going on. There was a guy called Mickey Mantle who was, you know, a legendary figure in baseball. And he was sort of, he basically took over Joe DiMaggio's position with the Yankees. And he was sort of like, you know, Mickey Mantle was like the all-American hero, Yankees hero, perfect model of American manhood. And basically Jim Buttongo was like, yeah, I like Mickey. He was a good guy, but he was also a boozer. He used to turn up like hungover sometimes. He used to like push kids out of the way when they were looking for autographs. You know, he'd play practical jokes where he'd get tell young teammates he was going to bring them for dinner and then send them to some slum in the middle of the ghetto or whatever. Like just the fact he was basically showing that all these guys were human, that they all basically, you know, cheated on their wives when they were on the road, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And then there's the struggle of the guy trying to hold on to his talent. He's developed, so he used to throw a fastball when he was younger, but that's gone. So now he's in his 30s and he has this thing called a knuckleball that he's trying to, and it's like a really slow pitch, but it's like really quirky pitch that he can have floated over there and the wind sort of takes it, you know, and the batter can't hit it. It's a really obscure pitch, but it's kind of like a metaphor for him because he's like the knuckleball of baseball players because he's not conventional. And ended up he was basically blacklisted from the game. He was basically told to apologize and come out and say that it was all a lie, and he refused to. He didn't play. I don't think he played for another team, except he came back years later when the book had kind of been accepted as a classic. And I think he played for the Atlanta Braves about 10 years later. But he was basically put out of the game. The ghostwriter, I think he was ostracized as well. And it just blew the whole, it blew the whole lid open on the whole thing. But it's just great fun to read as well.
It sounds like it was too good in the sense that it was too honest. And I feel like all the bland pablum that we have masquerading as sports autobiography since, that don't tell us anything is like this book is possibly to blame for.
It's interesting because I just picked it up to read and you know, I just had a look at the preface again. And he said at the time, I think the edition I have is like 10 years later, but that the idea was that like sport, you know, it shows how little has changed. Like he says, publishers love sports books because while they rarely make a lot of money, they never lose money. Quality is not important. Any book with a big name player on the cover is guaranteed to sell 5,000 copies, enough to recoup the printing costs. These books usually talk about how important it is to get a good night's sleep because the team sure needs to win that big game tomorrow. Since Ball 4, things have changed. So what he's saying is that like at the time, so Ball 4 came out and it was like, you can't write another like, you know, eat your greens and be good to your mom and pop. And so there was a whole slew of books there which looked to be even more sensational than that. But as you say, like, I think it's funny how things have kind of, it's almost like it kind of needs to be, you need another Ball 4 now because there's obviously still a market for those really, for that sort of stuff out there, that sort of, that really safe stuff. Like, but I mean, you know, to be doing that back in the late 60s, it's also actually, it's kind of the counterculture time in America as well. So, you know, it's part of that sort of scene as well. And he became really big on college campuses. So he was thrown out of baseball, but he ended up like touring college campuses doing talks because all the hippie, you know, anti-war kids loved this anti-establishment figure who basically stuck up his two fingers to the cozy word of baseball. And so it's great. It's got all those themes in it. Like, it's brilliant.
Amazing. You mentioned Eamon Dunphy. He's the author of our third pick, although it's not only a game, it's A Strange Kind of Glory, his biography of Matt Busby. Can you tell us about why you picked this?
I picked this because it's a lot of similar themes from the McAvaney Jock Stein obituary. First of all, it just absolutely blew my mind as a book. Like, I mean, I only read it a couple of years ago, so it was written in the early 90s or maybe the late 80s because it sort of refers to not sure about this Ferguson guy a couple of times later on. So it's obviously like it's been around a long time, and it really is like Dunphy at the peak of his powers as the sort of like, you know, Dunphy as best his writing like reflects it like his personality. It's jagged and it's angry and it's, you know, it's got such force of energy behind it. Like, and the book is, it's a biography of Matt Busby, but it's so much more. It's like a whole cultural history of again, that sort of, you know, development of working class culture and how football paralleled that, because in the early part of the 20th century, the bosses, i.e. the directors and the club owners, you know, they treated footballers like indentured slaves. And there's a whole, the early part of the book, there's a whole cultural history of the Irish community in Scotland and the Catholic community in Scotland and how they were treated and how that influenced Busby's development as a man. A lot of it is like trying to his painstaking construction of what made Busby what he was and the kind of, you know, the sort of complex character that he was. So like, instead of doing that in a chapter or in a couple of pages, Dunphy spends like, I don't know, there must be 100 pages about social history of West of Scotland, and then also the history, the early 20th century within the game of football and the efforts. There was the maximum wage, it was always in place, and I think in the early part of the 20th century it was like £7 a week was the maximum, so you could be, you know, the best player and the best team in the country, but you couldn't get paid more than £7 a week, which, you know, Dunphy says like that's obviously, I mean, that's a form of indentured servitude, of slavery. It was completely you know, it, and like Dunphy's like anger and his, that's the sort of thing that energizes him, as we know, you know, or certainly did at that time, that sort of passion. And it comes through. So he's building this story of Busby coming through. That's from a mining community, and there's you know, pit strikes that fail in the 1920s. You know, when he was a kid, coming up through football and being treated badly, and so then but it's the complexity of the character that he builds with Busby, who wanted to. So when Busby was a player, footballers got treated like shit, and they were treated like pieces of meat, and Busby wanted to treat his players with respect and treat them well and treat them with kindness and things like that. But he never he never threw money at them either. He never, there's a little bit of an edge to it where people were wondering, like, because around the time of the 50s and 60s when he was a manager, that was the time the players were really pushing for to end the maximum wage and to, you know, to be able to negotiate their own, you know, freedom of contract and all that sort of stuff. And Busby never really pushed for the players in that front, because at that time he was becoming, it was about the, you know, Manchester United was the important thing and the football club as the community. So he's taken all those strands of that have come from, like, he spends so much time developing where Busby came from that when you get to the bit of the club that he built, you understand where it all comes through. And then, so you understand so much more about Manchester United as a club and where they were. And it's great for that. Like, I'd recommend any United fan reads it who doesn't know much more about the club other than the trophies and the players and the Ferguson era, like, because it gives an unbelievable background into the club that Busby built. You know, you think about it coming in, I think, during the war, towards the end of the war, and then being there up until, late 60s, early 70s, and then obviously around, you know, when the subsequent managers were failing, he was around. Like, he was just basically there for you know, 40 years. And to think of, like, he's drawing on elements, like, I think it starts off with the immigration from post-famine Ireland, the Catholic mining communities in Scotland, the thing of how football was run in England, the state, all that kind of stuff. And it all builds into this unbelievably layered portrait. And Strange Kind of Glory is a great title because it's not like saying Matt Busby, what, you know, Matt Busby, the legend. It's not like, you know, what he says, like, I can't remember the exact ways. It's like saying this guy was so great that he deserves to be put the complexity of his character to be portrayed in the right way, in a way that really gets to grips with it. Like, it genuinely, when I read it, I kind of went, like, this is some stuff, you know.
In the Dunphy canon, I think it might be the best. It's also out of print now, I think, or it was going out of print last year or something. Now, this is, but I do get the sense that he is more proud of this than he is of anything else that he did. And now this is shameless name dropping, masquerading as profound insight. But I did interview Dunphy in his front room last year, and, you know, this big wall of books, like, it's absolutely, as you might imagine, of all kinds of genres, not just sport. But the only books pulled out and kind of stacked on a dresser by the walls of books were a couple of copies of the Busby book. And I think maybe Only a Game was there as well, yeah. And I asked him about it. It was like, you know, you must be kind of, like, this is kind of magnificent. And now it's going out of print and it might be lost to generations. And he did play it down, in fairness, but I wasn't fully convinced by it. And Tommy, does it talk much about how Busby changed after Munich?
Yeah, if I recall, there was a real sense that you know, he didn't talk about it, obviously, but there was a sense that, like, in the early 60s, you know, United were not they weren't in a good place, and, you know, there was a bit of a question as to, like, what's going on here. The club was there was a bit of drift in it, but, you know, as to his, I suppose you just get that enormous sense of strength that comes across, you know. And I think that whole chapter is just so, that whole part of the book about Munich is just it's so powerful on its own, you know. It's just, you know, building up how he put together that team. Like, there's a real, you know, putting together that team are so, like, this is amazing stuff. Like, and he's obviously at the peak of his powers, you know, as a manager, and then to, you know, to bring it back, like, I'd have to go back again, you know, to see was there a profound change. I mean, it has to have been. But I do remember it was never talked about, you know.
Yeah, we'll turn for home, Paddy, or for Tommy, even, because we have a couple of listener questions in here, and then we have our final couple of questions that we throw at everyone we have on the show. I said Paddy because this question is from a listener called Paddy. When pundits with managerial aspirations go on air, do they recognise, in your opinion, do they recognise that the need to, that they need to approach these gigs like a job interview, and so it means offering meaningful expertise and insight? He asks because there are some pundits, he says, who he feels drift further and further from landing a coaching role every time they go on air. Which I feel he's mentioning Roy Keane there, but in fairness, he doesn't name it.
Well, I can tell you for absolute certain that out of work managers view being on TV as part of the gig of keeping yourself in the line for potential jobs. Like it was no coincidence. Well, maybe it was a coincidence. I don't know. But when Mick McCarthy got the Ireland job after Martin O'Neill, he'd been doing TV with us, and it's like, you know, it obviously he'd left Ipswich a little time before, wanted to get back in. The Ireland job might come up in the future. No harm to do a bit of TV. In fairness, he was doing a bit of work with BT at the time as well. So they definitely view it as part of their portfolio of I'm still here. And when they're, and I suppose when they're not working, they probably think, well, they can't do anything wrong, so they're always going to look better than the other guy. And every manager can probably sound better. I know what you're saying about Roy. I don't know if he still has aspirations to be a manager anymore, because where he is now with his punditry is so performative as a pundit that, like, I think he surely knows that ship has sailed. Yeah. But others definitely view it. I think, you know, somebody like you'll see the likes of Pochettino going on Sky. Like, that was very clearly, I'm here, I'm ready, let's go, to somebody that would have him. So I have no doubt when you see an out of work manager on TV, it's not because he wants to be on TV, it's because he wants a job.
I have a really contrived question for you, unfortunately. Would you, as an anchor, could you name a fantasy panel of pundits? We'll give you three, and they can be from any era. So let's not limit ourselves to just today's pundits. We can go back to ITV in the 70s.
Okay, Brian Clough.
Yeah.
Because if you ever see the old clips of him, I think it was like the first ever idea of a panel, I think ITV did for the 1970 World Cup. And he's just brilliant every time the camera's on him. So he'd be there. You can't see, the thing is, like, it's all about chemistry. It's all about casting. So you couldn't have Clough, Dunphy, and, you know, another agent provocateur. Like, so you'd have to have Clough. You'd have to have a younger guy like a Gary Neville, who's opinionated, but I would annoy Clough enough so that Clough would spend a lot of the time making kind of like raising his eyebrow at the stuff that Neville says. And then you need the sort of the senior analyst, as Bill used to call Gilesy. So, like, that's your sort of your Giles or your Souness or your, you know, that sort of, like, Alan Hansen in his day was brilliant. Like, people forget how good he was because he started honing it in a bit towards the end. But I mean, he was, you know, he kind of pushed it forward a good bit in the 90s when he came on the scene. So I think, you know, I think I've had a sort of like a, you know, an understudy. So you have Dunphy understudying for Clough. You'd maybe have, you'd have to have a sort of a modern sort of guy who can work all the arrows and stuff, kind of Neville figure, with maybe a kind of a Carragher or somebody like as a backup then, and maybe a kind of a Souness Giles rotation, something like that. I think the chemistry of that would be quite good.
And you're backing yourself to handle Clough, obviously.
Oh, I'd be... I'd be like, get me back to the bank. I'd love to have just been around him in his prime, like, just, you know, just somebody with that magnetic force of personality would have been amazing.
Final two questions, Tommy. Who is the most interesting person you've met with work?
Good question. God, like, I know we talked about him. But there is nobody that I've met who sort of can change the whole vibration of a room as much as Keane when he's in it. And one of my very first jobs, I was freelancing for TV3. He was managing Sunderland in the in a pre-season friendly against Bohemians, and I got a call, you know, to say, look, would you go along and try and grab Roy for a word after the match? And I was just like, yeah, sure. So I went along, and Sunderland paid Bose, I think they won like 2-0 or something like that. And it's actually Paul McShane's debut after he signed for Sunderland. And I said, right, this is the moment now. What's he going to do? Like, so I approached with the camera. It was very informal because it was a preseason friendly. There was no rights holders or anything. It was just like try and grab him for a word. So basically got Pat Fenlon for a word just to, you know, make myself not look bad. And then I was like, right, Roy's there. He's kind of floating around. And then basically made the move up to him. And was expecting to be sort of just absolutely brushed off and walked past. But he was in charming mood that night. And I remember just like throwing like the most ridiculous like softball questions. Like, but I just remember it's the first time I'd ever, like, I'd obviously seen him throughout his playing career and with Ireland and everything. And we're only like 5 years on from Saipan at this stage. I just remember like just that the intensity of the eyes. And you know, when you see somebody you've only seen, you know, on TV and in magazine billboards, like, you notice little things like just crow's feet and a little bit of dried spittle around his mouth from obviously shouting during the match. And you know, it was kind of a late summer evening, so it's based on that kind of like film of dried sweat on it and stuff, and like just that sort of human. But then suddenly it's just fixing you with those eyes, you know, and they're really. And it couldn't have been in a less intense environment. Like, it's literally a pre-season friendly that they've just won with an interviewer who is like definitely not going to ask him, were you right to walk out? Did you walk out? Or so it was just like, Roy, happy with the performance? Yeah, it was a great performance. Great for it. And then I said, and Paul McShane making a debut today. He looked assured out there, didn't he? And he says, assured, that's a good word. Yeah, I think he did look assured. I said, thanks, Roy. Thanks for your time. I handed the tape to the cameraman to bring it back to the studio, and I was done then. And I was meeting some friends in town in a pub that night. It was a Saturday evening, and I just walked in like the hero. I couldn't believe it. This is it now. I've made it now. But I've interviewed him loads of times over the years, and never known anybody to just change the whole frequency of a room. And I suppose over the years he's become aware of that, and he obviously is aware of it now when he does his TV stuff. That's one of his great powers. Great book by Owen O'Callaghan, who 42 stalwart as well, about his younger times at Forest and before that Cove, and just seeing that person up, you know, and the fact he's just remained such a compelling figure, you know.
And our last question is, the most interesting place you've been with work?
Probably off the top of my head, I'm going to say covering Ireland Euro 2012 in Sopot, where the team were staying and also 10,000 fans were staying. And just the crazy juxtaposition of the team were staying in this like hotel, seaside hotel. And sometimes you'd see like the reserve goalkeeper and a couple of subs out for a wander, but generally they seem to be cooped up in this hotel all the time, while the biggest, most drunken stag party of all time was taking place outside their hotel windows. And I always remember, you know, reading the Champagne Football book, you know, it was like when John Delaney was in his socializing prime, and being around that time and being in a bar, and he was on his own. Sorry, he was in the bar, and then I kind of looked at him and said, "He looks like he's kind of on his own because he's not really with anybody. Maybe there were people, but he was definitely tour. He was definitely one. You know, he was definitely holding court in the bar from people to people. And he saw me, and he kind of went, "Ah, Tommy, how are you?" And I said, "John, you're enjoying yourself, are you?" And he goes, "What other chief executive of a football association in Europe would you see doing this?" That is a great. That is a great summary of everything that's going on right now. So it was, So little did we know that years later it would be like develop into one of the sort of central moments of his story. Like, but that was just an incredibly memorable time. It was my first time covering Ireland at a major tournament, or you know, which doesn't happen terribly often. So that was really interesting because it was the sort of from the high of hope and excitement and joy to the absolute desolation of the performances. And my son was 1 year old. I missed his first birthday when I was onto that. And I just remember at the end, you know, we were away for 3 weeks, just like wanting to get home so much. And, you know, just kind of feeling like, God, this is, yeah. You know, this is not what it was supposed to be. But yeah, it's obviously a great memory for all that.
That's the whole John Delaney story told there. Incredible. Tommy, that was absolutely fantastic. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Gavin. Thanks for your time.
Thank you to Tommy. And thank you, listener, as ever, for supporting Behind the Lines and the 42 as a whole. I know I say it every week, so I hope it doesn't sound trite or tired at this point, but it is greatly appreciated because, well, we couldn't do this show and a number of the other things we do without you. So thank you very, very much. We will be back next week with another great guest here on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.